91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. The three most despised professions in America list as follows: members of Congress, car sales, then lawyers. The latter have probably spawned more jokes than any other, and even Wall Street traders incur less enmity. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with South Florida criminal defense attorney Brian Tannenbaum. No one is more critical of his profession than he. His new book is mostly aimed at fellow lawyers, but it's revealing for all readers. His signature style, blunt and opinionated. We'll learn more about his book, The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering, in a few minutes. First, this NPR and Regional News Update. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, on this Tuesday afternoon. Most people think a law degree should easily put one on easy street, especially with paper from Yale, Harvard, Stanford, or the like.
But South Florida-based attorney Brian Tannenbaum is an exception. He's a Stetson University law grad. He's been referred to as the lawyer that other lawyers go to when they land in hot water.
And he's here to discuss the legal profession's rights and wrongs with us, as charted in his new book, The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering.
Welcome to you, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you. So let's start a little. You're an anomaly. You're from Miami. You were born here. Tell us a little about your background, your education, and your law background.
Well, I am born and raised in Miami, and I went to Miami Killian Senior High School, and then I went to Tampa to the University of South Florida. Then I went to Stetson, as you said, and then I came back and became an assistant public defender and went into private practice, and now I'm here.
And how long have you been in private practice?
I've been private practice since 1997, practicing for 21 years.
In your book, you show special disdain for lawyers who put so much of their energy into web and social media client recruiting. Give us the basics of that.
Well, I'm a relationship guy, and when I started practicing, the internet was kind of in its infancy, and the way that we built our practice was by having lunch with people, doing good things in court and for clients, and letting people in the world know that we actually knew what we were doing by practicing law and representing clients in the real world. Now I see lawyers who are creating false images of themselves on the internet for the sole purpose of getting clients, and I think it hurts both clients, and I think it hurts the profession.
But it's also a blessing in terms of marketing. You use a lot of social media yourself. You're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, you're on LinkedIn. And even I would think it's a blessing in terms of discovery and investigation, a tool.
Right. So the misnomer about me is that I'm the anti-tech guy, and I'm not. I have a lot of technology, and I use technology all day, every day. But I believe that it's part of a lawyer's practice. And yes, I do believe that it's a blessing to be able to talk to an unlimited amount of people on the internet 24 hours a day. But I think for clients out there who are looking for lawyers, they need to understand that what you're reading on the internet is not necessarily what you're going to get when you write that check to that lawyer.
You really rail against attorneys who try and they put so much effort into trying to be with keywords and things to come up first on Google. And that.
Well, I mean, look, you're trying to be the number one person on the internet. Let's go back to the Yellow Pages, which
Associates.
Right. So the key was you wanted to be the first name in the Yellow Pages because people looked at the first name and they started going down the list. And that's what people do on the internet. But that's why I start the book with the question of what type of lawyer do you want to be? Do you want to be that volume type lawyer, which is fine. We need those kinds of lawyers. But do you want to be that kind of lawyer that's taking calls all day from people who are saying, I found you on the internet?
I want to continue with that because I want to ask you, well, how do you do successful marketing now and building successful relationships as an attorney. But before we go there, I want to start with something you start with in your book. You address your personal code of conduct. You have your personal code of conduct and ethics. And I presume that's the most important thing to you because you do have that right at the beginning. So what prompted you to write one and why is it important to you?
It's a very good story. One day I had a criminal case and a prosecutor had sent me a letter and the letter said, I just want to let you know how I practice law. And I'd never received a letter like that. And I first was a little troubled by it because I thought to myself, I don't need another lawyer telling me how they practice law. And then I kept reading it and I thought, you know, this is an interesting thing to do. So I sat down and I said, well, how do I practice law? And I wrote down my personal code of ethics. Because there is the code of ethics, which to me is the bottom, it's the floor, it's the basics, and then it's how I practice law. And so I felt like if I wrote it down and I kept it, that it would be something that I could use on a daily basis. And I encourage lawyers to do it themselves.
Obviously not going into specifics, but generally, what sort of criminal defense cases do you handle?
Well,
give us an example of some.
You know, it's evolved. I started as a public defender, so my cases were anything I was appointed to. Now, 21 years later, most of my cases are what people refer to as white collar. I represent professionals who are in trouble with some type of monetary fraud. I don't do a lot of violent crimes anymore because my office is downtown, and those types of people generally aren't walking down Flagler Street looking for a lawyer. So most of my cases are people who have gotten into trouble with some kind of financial problem, some type of fraud.
You tell it at the beginning of the book also about this email that you received from an attorney who told you what you were going to do, when you were going to do it, how you were going to do it, and you wrote back with one sentence. Tell us about that and go ahead.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because that chapter of the book has gotten a tremendous amount of feedback from young lawyers, and that is how to deal with threatening and demanding opposing counsel. And yes, I received an email, and the email basically said, you know, here's all the things you're going to do by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And it was a very lengthy email. And my response was one sentence, and it was this email meant for me? And I received no response to that except that another lawyer in the firm contacted me and we worked the case out and everything resolved itself. And what I try to tell lawyers about that issue, and that's in my personal code of ethics, is don't ever behave like the other lawyer. Behave like yourself. If that other lawyer is going up in terms of his temperament or her temperament or demeanor, getting angry, you need to bring it down a level because you're never going to win acting like the other lawyer.
What do you demand of clients? What can they or what should they do and what shouldn't they do with you?
When a client comes in my office and they've decided to retain me, one of the things that I tell them is that there's two things that I demand from a client. Number one is be on time. And that's either be on time to my office or be on time to court because those things are important and that shows a responsible client. The second thing that I say to clients is, listen, I'm going to give you advice. You don't have to take it, but you have to listen to me. I've been doing this a long time. You came and you hired me for a specific reason. You've got to let me talk. You've got to let me give you advice. You can't be the one saying, this is how we're going to do things, because if that's going to be your position, I'm not the right lawyer for you.
Another important aspect of your book is balancing being a good and ethical lawyer. And I still want to talk more about your code of ethics and serving your clients well, but running a business successfully, because in order to, you know, to be a good lawyer, you're going to have to be a good businessman in some respects, although you call it a profession. So how do you balance that?
Well, this is what I say to people, because we're now in a world where people say it's a business. Well, it's always been a business. If you're in private practice, law is a business. But first, it is a profession. And the reason it's a profession is because we have licenses. And we get licenses because we have sworn to uphold a certain code of ethics. So the balance is that you have to balance your desire to make money and your desire to build a law firm or build a clientele with the rules that you agreed to follow. And that is a very important issue to me when people are arguing in today's world that it's a business, it's a business, it's a business. We have to keep in mind that it's not the same type of business as every other business because we have licenses and we have sworn to uphold certain codes of ethics.
One thing you also kind of rail against is that the kind of lawyer, probably a young lawyer, of course, who does a lot of their practice, their work at Starbucks. that they wear shorts and t-shirt and they're in Starbucks using an iPad and practicing law that way.
You know, one of the things that I've gotten some feedback from people who work in state bar associations is that I've mentioned to them that it seems like today when students are graduating from law school, instead of their desire being to go work in a law office, their desire is to go home, put on their pajamas, and work from a computer. And I include Starbucks in that. And I always wonder, when people went to law school, if their desire was to get a law degree, become licensed, and go home. Because I think it's important as a young lawyer that you are around other lawyers. Besides the fact that when you're working out of a coffee shop, I don't believe you can maintain client confidences the same way you can in an office.
If you're going to be a lawyer, dress like one. Is that your point?
I think there's nothing wrong with being casual on days where no one's going to be around. But yes, if you want to be taken seriously, I always tell people, marketing is from the minute you leave your house to the minute you go home. When you walk in that courthouse or you walk in that office building, the way you are dressed tells people how serious you are about your profession. And if you walk in the courthouse and you're in a wrinkled sport coat and khaki pants and unshined shoes compared to the lawyer standing next to you who's in a full dark blue suit with a white crisp shirt, that's going to make a difference to the judge, to opposing counsel, and to the clients. And not just your clients, but potential clients. Because I can tell you, there's been a lot of times I've walked out of a courtroom and someone in the gallery has gotten up, followed me out of the courtroom and said, "Can I have your card?"
How do you receive most of your clients?
Well, most of my clients are referrals. Most of my clients do not come from the internet. I always tell people the shortest conversation I will have on a daily basis is, "Hi, I found you on the internet." Because as I tell people, there's only two reasons anybody goes to the internet. Number one is to get information, and number two is to find the cheapest deal on whatever you're looking for. I'm not the cheapest deal on whatever you're looking for, and I don't want to be that because that would make my practice increase in terms of the amount of clients, and I want to be able to pay attention to the clients that I have. So most of my clients are through referrals. I will tell you that when I left the public defender's office, I took out a piece of paper and I wrote a letter to every single person I knew, person who cut my hair, former public defender clients who I knew had no money, people in the community, and I said, "I'm going into private practice. If anybody gets arrested, have them call me." And that's how I started building my practice.
You mentioned cards, and you mentioned referrals, two things I want to talk about. One thing is, though, you don't believe in having a business card, you say. Why?
Well, because I think not having a business card is a way to have a conversation. And let me explain that to you. You go to a cocktail party, someone comes up to you, and they hand you a business card immediately and say, "I'm a mortgage broker. If you need a mortgage, call me." And I throw that card in the garbage. I'm not going to have a relationship with somebody over a business card. The reason I don't carry a card is because you can give me your card and then I'll send you an email and we'll have a conversation. I just think cards are a distraction from having a real conversation with people. And people disagree with it, but that's my position.
Okay, we're going to get to much more. We're speaking with Brian Tannenbaum. He's a criminal defense attorney with Tannenbaum Weiss, now in his 21st year of practice. And he's written The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering. We'll be right back.
We haven't heard that jingle in a while.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Brian Tannenbaum, a criminal defense attorney with Tannenbaum Weiss. And he's written The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering. So getting to that question, we will open the phones. Stay with us. We will get to you. You do mention referrals now, but yet you speak a lot about referral fees in terms of legality versus ethics. So tell us your views on that.
Well, I don't take referral fees and I don't give referral fees. And I've gotten into some very heated debates with lawyers about this. I'm a relationship guy. I believe in relationships. If I refer you a case, my sense is that at some point you're going to refer me a case. And I tell people, you know, especially in the personal injury world where they really insist on giving referral fees, listen, if you make a ton of money on this case, that's a different story. But I'm not going to take a few hundred dollars out of your pocket because you got a few thousand dollars for a fee. I just don't believe in it. I've had people call me and say, you know, "Will you give me a referral fee?" And I say, "No, I'm not giving you a check because you made a phone call." But people disagree with that. And referral fees are ethical in Florida. They're called partial participation fees, but the lawyers have to participate in part of the case, although they rarely do. I just don't believe in it.
So when you say if there was a big case, I mean, do you lose referrals as a result of that?
Oh, yes. I've had lawyers call me and say, I have a case for you. You can have it. Will you give me a referral fee? And I say no. And I never hear from the client. So yes, I do lose cases by not giving referral fees, but it's just something I don't believe in.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with Brian Tannenbaum, 1-800-743-9576. Or email, that's radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org.
Do you consider yourself a satisfied and fulfilled attorney? We're going to get to that. Perhaps you're thinking about becoming a lawyer. Why and how do you market yourself? Do you have a code of ethics? We'd love to hear from you. What do you mean when you say the future of law is officially a joke?
Well, this is the new terminology that is out. And it's funny because yesterday I got an email asking me if I would come moderate a panel on the future of law. And I said, yes, I'll be right there. You know, people talk about the future of law as if one day clients are not going to meet with lawyers ever. Lawyers are not going to have offices anywhere. Everything is going to be virtual. And people kind of refer to that as the Uberization of the law profession. People are going to point and click their way to legal advice and things. And in a certain way, that may happen. You may be able to get a will online. You may be able to get a contract online. But a crying mother because her son is in trouble somewhere is going to want to go to an office, close the door, and sit down with somebody in a suit and say, do you understand my legal dilemma? That's never going to change. So when people talk about the future of law, what they're doing is they're selling lawyers on a new way of practicing law, which in certain disciplines is going to happen and is already happening. But I always say there's always going to be room for somebody who needs to, in person, understand another person's legal problem, and technology is never going to change that.
How do you get along with judges?
I mean, I get along with judges fine. I think it's part of the system. You know, judges have a job to do, and there's days I go into court and I have a heated debate with a judge. But again, I go back to what I discussed before. We have a code of ethics. We have a way that we're supposed to treat judges. And, you know, a good judge will say, listen, if you don't like what I do here, you know, appeal me. There's a way to handle that. So, you know, I've never been held in contempt. Have I had bad days in court? Have I walked out and said, you know, I don't like that judge, and I hope in the next...
Do lawyers discuss judges amongst themselves? Uh-oh, I've got that Judge Taney.
Well, lawyers discuss judges, and judges discuss lawyers. And I think a lot of lawyers don't really absorb that concept, that judges talk just as much as lawyers do. And judges know when a certain lawyer walks in their courtroom what to think of that lawyer's ethics. There's lawyers who are just always late to court all over the buildings, and the judges know it. So it's a conversation that occurs within the judges and within the lawyers. And yes, we lawyers talk about judges all the time, and judges know it.
So how do you build a successful practice? You talk about, you know, you do it through relationships. Well, how do you find those relationships? Do you network? I mean,
well,
go ahead.
Yeah. You know, let's take, you know, Dade County, where we have over 3 million people, and that's a lot of people, but the legal community is small. It's about 15, 16,000 people, and people think, well, that's a lot of lawyers. But there's bar associations, there's networking organizations, there's friends of friends. And I think the way to build a successful relationship comes from how you're going to wind up getting the case. The best case I get is when somebody calls me and says, I asked around for a lawyer who did what you did, and two people gave me your name. At that point, there's really not much for me to do in terms of selling that client on why they should hire me, because they've talked to two people they trust or like or know, and they've been given my name. So I think the way to build a successful practice is to develop good relationships with lawyers who don't do what you do, people in the community who are in trustworthy positions. I mean, you have to think about how the average person would hire a lawyer. They'd go to someone they know who maybe had a legal problem or someone they trust. They may go to their doctor and say, do you know a lawyer who does personal injury work? And that's going to be a good referral. So I think the best way to build a successful practice is to build good relationships with people who are trustworthy to other people.
What advantage does one have with a degree from Harvard, Yale, Duke, as opposed to, say, Stetson?
Well, I've always felt that certain schools have very good alumni networks. Harvard is one of them. Harvard has a very outstanding alumni network, and other schools don't. So, you know, for example, I went to Stetson, which is in the west central coast of Florida, where 87% of people who graduate from Stetson stay in that area. So I'm kind of an anomaly, as you said, in South Florida. There's not a lot of Stetson graduates in South Florida, but it's good in the sense that I know a lot of them because we're kind of a group that knows each other. So I think, you know, are you a smarter lawyer because you went to Harvard as opposed to a Stetson or University of Miami? You're being taught the same thing, maybe by different professors, but I think in the end, it's the relationships you can develop through the alumni network that can help you.
Or if you want to go to what you say in the book, big law, business law.
Right, because big law firms like that. They like to go to their clients when they're going out for, let's say, a bank and to say, listen, you know, 40% of our graduates went to Ivy League law schools. You know, that's an impressive thing for a client. It may not mean anything, but to the client, it means something. You know, 75% of our lawyers graduated in the top 5% of their class. That means something to a client.
You say that the best lawyers in the U.S. work for the government. Why is that?
Well, they're in court every single day, for the most part. I'm talking about assistant U.S. attorneys, state attorneys, public defenders, assistant federal defenders, county attorneys. These are lawyers who are litigating matters every single day, and I think they're sharp, and I think they are an unknown quantity when it comes to the legal profession because they're not out building business. They're not out there trying to get clients. They've got all the clients they want. But there are so many unknown lawyers in government offices that are just phenomenal lawyers in the courtroom and in the pleadings that they draft.
So do you think they do it for the stability?
Well, there's a certain amount of comfort that comes from working in a government job. You get benefits, you get a salary, you don't have to worry about whether the copy machine has paper in it, you don't have to worry about whether rent needs to be paid. It is a trade-off. You're going to get paid less money in the beginning, you may get a nice pension, but I think there is a comfort level that comes from going to work every day and not having to worry about whether the phone's going to ring.
We're going to take some calls in just a moment. One more question. In the book, you talk about that it seems that the lawyers who spout the most advice are actually the ones who have been unsuccessful. Why is that?
Well, this is a big thing for me because I find a lot of people in the advice business are failed lawyers. They spend their days, their careers, giving advice to lawyers. And I always say, well, why are they not practicing law? And I tell people, if you're going to take advice from somebody on a paid basis on how to build your practice, a marketing person, go to somebody with a marketing background. Because you have to ask yourself when you're talking to someone who used to practice law, why don't you practice law anymore? And I know for a fact that lawyers don't ask that question. And I think that's a big problem.
So you're saying don't go to lawyers for marketing advice. Go to someone who is in marketing.
I think if you're going to go to a lawyer for marketing advice, you go to a successful lawyer who's still practicing. And you take them out to lunch, you take them out for coffee and say, how did you build your practice? I don't think that you pay a former lawyer to tell you how to build a practice when they're no longer practicing law.
Let's take a telephone call before our break. This is Adrian in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. Brian, question I have for you. My son just graduated from George Mason's law school, and right now he's in the black hole. The black hole being he's taken the bar exam, won't get his bar results till the end of October. Now, he doesn't have a job, obviously, but I've been trying to help him figure out what's the best way to network and what would be impressive to you to want to hire a young associate like him.
That's a great question. I will tell you the changes that I've seen since I graduated law school in 1994, and that is that law students now have business cards. They have no job, but they have business cards, and I think that's an interesting thing. I also see law students networking more and more. I will go to my monthly wine tasting, or I will go to a bar event, and I will see a law student there who just graduated, just took the bar, and is just trying to meet people, and I have seen it work. I think that your son needs to get out there. I think he needs to meet as many lawyers as he can. He needs to call lawyers or email them and say, hey, listen, this is my situation. Maybe other lawyers who went to George Mason. Can I buy you a cup of coffee? Can I sit down and talk with you? And eventually something's going to happen. I know that doesn't sound great, but I think that law students need to spend more time these days networking with lawyers when they're in law school and after they graduate, because we get resumes all day. And if we haven't met the lawyer, it makes a difference. If we've met somebody, we may wind up giving them a call or sending them an email and saying, hey, listen, there's an opening. Would you like to come in and talk about it?
Thank you. It's kind of funny because that's what happened to him. He had one of his professors, his family law professor, had gotten promoted to senior partner in his firm. And, of course, the students at George Mason were invited. My son was the only one who showed up. And consequently, there he is with a lot of family law attorneys in Fairfax County, and a lot of them were, you know, they took, my son doesn't have a card, but my son collected quite a few cards, and he actually did get called in for an interview at his law professor's law firm, but they just recently contacted me and said, we don't have enough work right now to hire you. But I told my son, I said, look, go back to your professor, I said, because people talk, you know, and your professor may know other attorneys, other family law practice attorneys that have openings.
Okay. We have to run.
Thank you,
Adrian. Very much for your call.
We're speaking with Brian Tannenbaum, criminal defense attorney with Tannenbaum Weiss. We didn't mention this yet, but we will. I'll tell you, he's a certified sommelier. We'll get to that, too, on Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with attorney Brian Tannenbaum. He's the author of The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering. And if you'd like to call in with a comment or a question, you're welcome to 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@wlrn.org.
Okay, so Brian, let's say you're an attorney, you've done everything right, you haven't done, you know, trying to get your name first on Google, you've done everything right, you still can't seem to find enough clients to pay the bills. What do you do?
Well, the one thing I talk about in the book, and I've talked about a lot, is that lawyers are unwilling to check their ego when it comes to business. Lawyers don't like to talk about when things are slow. And I think lawyers need to do that more. When things are slow and you're not getting clients, you need to talk to people about that and find out if there's anything you can do. Because when you open up to people, and I know lawyers don't like to do this, especially other lawyers, because we want to make everyone think everything's great, you may get a piece of advice, or you may get something like, well, you know what, I actually have this case that I'm not going to take, and maybe I'll, you know, hand it over to you and you can do it. I think lawyers need to talk more. And I think that the biggest problem when you're not getting clients is figuring out what you're doing wrong in terms of networking and marketing, and maybe changing it up a little bit. If you're not getting out there, if you're not going to cocktail parties or bar events, maybe you need to do that a little bit more. If you've, you know, not caught up with that person who's been wanting to have lunch with you, maybe you, you know, reconnect with that person. I think you need to double your efforts when you're not getting clients and the things that you're not doing marketing-wise.
Isn't it just sometimes cyclical, though, that, you know, it's just like summer for restaurants?
That's an excellent point, because that's another reason why you talk to lawyers and you say, wow, things are kind of slow for me the last couple of weeks. Let me call my friend who does what I do. Are things slow for you? Yeah, I know things have been slow for me too. And then you go in the courthouse and things are kind of quiet and you realize, okay, it's not me. And that doesn't pay the bills, but I think it helps lawyers feel a little bit better about the situation.
What effect did the 2008 crash have on the legal field?
The 2008 crash was interesting because it killed the real estate lawyers. I had real estate lawyers coming to me and
saying, nobody was buying.
Right. You know, right. Do you have any work for me? And what kind of work? Anything. I'll do anything just to, you know, do some legal work. It really had a huge effect on those types of practices. The criminal practice, to me, it didn't really have much of an effect. But I can tell you in the lawyer defense practice, it was a benefit for me in the sense that clients were looking for money. And the way they were looking for money was by filing complaints against their lawyers. And some lawyers got scared and wrote checks, and other lawyers, you know, I helped them and we resolved the cases. But that was a time when people were looking to their lawyers to blame them for what was going on financially and trying to get fees back.
Like violation of fiduciary responsibilities.
You charged me too much money. You didn't do what you told me you were going to do. I paid you X amount of dollars, and I want some money back.
What about, though, remuneration? Let's say you had clients during 2008 who fell on hard times and couldn't pay you, and you had done the work, and they weren't objecting to what you charged. They just didn't have the money.
Well, that's an ongoing thing with clients where, you know, they don't pay, and I try to tell lawyers, and lawyers will disagree with me, but I say that's your fault. You need to figure out how you're going to get paid. You know, if you're worried about getting paid, get paid up front. Take a credit card, even if you have to pay a percentage of the fee to the credit card company, because if you put clients on a payment plan, it's really what I refer to as a non-payment plan. And I think when the client winds up not paying and you look to the client, you should really look to yourself as to how you structured that payment deal.
Should you always have a written agreement with a client, even if they're close, family member, friends, whatever?
Some of the biggest problems I have with lawyers is complaints filed against them on cases where the fees were $500. And the answer I get from the lawyer was, it was only $500. I knew the client from before, and I always say, break out a cocktail napkin. I don't care where you write the retainer agreement, but you should always have something in writing that says, here's what you paid me, and here's what I'm going to do.
Let's take another call. This is George in Miami. Welcome. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon, Counselor Tenenbaum. I'm George, and I'm in the real estate business, and I was a witness to this situation. There was a real estate litigation, and my customer went to an attorney. He billed a lot of hours. A few days before the hearing, he says that there were irreconcilable differences between the client and the attorney, and made a petition to the court to withdraw. And that was a few days just before hearing. And that instance repeated itself like three times, and after billing several thousands of dollars, not a small change like $500 that you just mentioned. So what is the situation? I was asking my customer to file a complaint to the bar, but, you know, what would be the ethics on this case?
Well, I don't know the specific details of the case, but I can tell you in general that there's a rule that says that lawyers cannot charge what's called a clearly excessive fee. And that means that the bar does not regulate how much a lawyer gets paid for a certain case, but a lawyer can only get paid what the bar determines is reasonable. And the example I give is, if a lawyer is paid $100,000 for a case at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday, and Wednesday the case goes away, the lawyer can't really claim the $100,000 unless there's some extenuating circumstances. So in the situation that you describe, what I would want to know is, what was the work that the lawyer did? What were the irreconcilable differences between the lawyer and the client? And is it worth it to even go to the bar, because the bar is not a fee refund agency. The bar is there to discipline lawyers for ethical violations. So if the fee was clearly excessive for the work that was done in the case, then the bar will investigate and they may recommend mediation. But it may be a situation where you go to the lawyer yourself, or the client goes to the lawyer and asks the lawyer if they want to work the case out between themselves.
Can you talk about generally the dilemma that an attorney may have between legality and ethics, or between morality and ethics?
Right. I mean, I get this a lot from lawyers who, you know, they'll call and they'll say, you know, this situation happened, you know, can I do this? And more and more, my first answer to them is, well, why are you calling me? And there's usually a pause, and what do you mean, why am I calling you? You say, well, if you're calling me, you obviously think there's something wrong, or there could possibly be something wrong. So let's start there. And then I start with, you know, well, here's what the rule says. And yes, it may be ethical. Maybe you can do this under the rules, but what is it that you're trying to accomplish? When I was a young lawyer, I had a mentor, and he used to ask me this question all the time. And it was a very frustrating question. You know, what are you trying to accomplish? And I think the problem with lawyers sometimes is they don't think about long-term relationships. You get in a tussle with opposing counsel. You know, can you file a bar complaint? Sure. Do you want to? Probably not. Same thing with criminal lawyers. You know, do you want to file a motion that the prosecutor was committing misconduct? Well, if they really were committing misconduct, yes. But in general, when you do that, there's a lot more happening outside of the ethics world that's going to affect how you practice. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't do things like that, but you just need to think about, beyond the ethics rules, what you're doing.
We have a tweet from Sherwin who wants to know if having money gets you better service from an attorney, since the justice system in the United States is built on the back of poor minorities.
Well, that's an ongoing conversation. I will tell you this. Some of the best victories in criminal cases in this country have been by public defenders. When you pay a lawyer a lot of money, generally, that lawyer should be putting a lot of time into your case to try to defend you. When people come in my office and say, what's the difference between you and a public defender? I say, number one, the public defender is not going to get your case until after you go to court for the first time. And that's a delay that you may not want to wait to start negotiating with the prosecutor or start defending the case. So you need to think about that.
You mean after the indictment.
Right, exactly. Right. So if someone's under investigation, they're not going to get a public defender. When they get arrested and then they go to court, then they're going to get a public defender. So it's not, I mean, I'm a former public defender. It's not necessarily that they're bad lawyers, but as compared to me, that I may have 20 cases going on at a time, they may have 200. And when you have that many cases going on, obviously time is an issue and you can't devote as much time to each client as someone like me can. That doesn't make you not as good of a lawyer. Time is limited.
So in answer to Sherwin's question, you would say?
I think I would tell Sherwin that you should expect if you pay a good lawyer a lot of money that that lawyer should do what the lawyer is supposed to do. Results are never guaranteed.
Right.
You could get a public defender for free and get a superior defense to a private lawyer because there's also private lawyers who are taking on too many cases. But I don't believe generally that, you know, there was just a federal case in Miami last week where the public defender won the case. It was a $300 million fraud case and got straight acquittal across the board, and that lawyer was paid zero by the client.
Let's take another call before our break. Bruno in Miami Beach, hi.
Hi. Yeah, attorney there was commenting about finding an attorney on the internet, but I'd just like to make a comment that I was in need of an attorney. And I had a really hard time trying to find an attorney. You know, I didn't know who to talk. You know, thank goodness I happened to have an acquaintance who's a paralegal, and she told me about Avo and another one that begins with an M, Martin Hubble, I think it is. But, you know, I had to go on the internet because I didn't know where A from Z, where to start, you know, to find an attorney. And I ended up, it was such a hard time. I'm finding a good qualified attorney. I'm on my fourth law firm. They're finally doing a reasonably good job, you know, but I spent wasted a lot of time and energy and emotion and money getting to that fourth law firm. And, you know, so, I mean, you're saying, I mean, don't go to the internet, but, you know, where do you go if you're not connected into the legal community, you know, like somebody like me? And then that's my question. And then a comment about just the problem about access to the legal system. It's like if you don't have money, you know, it's hard to get a good attorney, you know, and get representation because of all the money I spent on the previous law firms. And then in a disadvantaged situation now with this current law firm because I don't really direct as much the drive the case because I'm not able to pay directly anymore. I'm gonna, you know, so. Thank you for your
sure.
Okay, thank you, Bruno.
Yeah, let me just clarify something about, you know, this don't go to the internet. I believe that the internet is a great place to start or finish when you're looking for a lawyer. But if you're starting there because you don't know anybody in the legal system, you go to one of the websites, whether it's Avo, Martindale Hubble, or just Google your issue and pick up, you know, a couple of names and start looking at websites. I don't think that should be the end. I think once you do that, then you pick up the phone or send an email to somebody, a couple of friends. I mean, you may not want to disclose your legal issue, and I understand that. But if it's a civil thing and it's not a big deal to you personally in terms of people finding out, then you just send an email and say, does anyone know this lawyer or this law firm? The people that you communicate with may not know, but they may say to you, listen, I'll get back to you because my friend is a lawyer or my cousin's a lawyer. Let me find out about these names. So all I'm saying about the internet is I don't think it should be the beginning or the end in terms of the only thing that you do. I think in the middle of that, you need to do other research before hiring a lawyer.
Bruno mentioned Martindale Hubble, and I'm wondering about that. Is that a good, are there peer review sites where people can go and see how their attorney has been rated? And
right. Well, the leading peer review site now is avo.com. And Avo rates lawyers, and also lawyers can put whatever information they have about everything they've done in their career. But the one thing I will caution people about is negative reviews, because sometimes clients don't win. And when they don't win, They don't just leave a negative review about the fact that they didn't win. They'll say whatever they have to say in order to make the lawyer look bad. So you have to be very careful about just reading a negative review about a lawyer and assuming that it's true. So yes, there are peer review sites, but you should not just rely on those when you're thinking about hiring a lawyer.
Martin Tannenbaum, criminal defense attorney with Tannenbaum Weiss. He's written The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. On this Tuesday, we're visiting with attorney Brian Tannenbaum, and we're talking about his book, The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering. Brian, why did you write this book?
I was asked. That's the answer I always give.
Published by the ABA.
Right. Well, what happened was, over the years, and I think a lot of lawyers go through this, I always say every lawyer has a book in them. People had asked me, you know, because I do a lot of writing, are you interested in writing a book? And I would say I didn't have time. And then finally, a lawyer in Miami who I was friendly with said, are you interested in writing a book? And I said, maybe. And he said, well, I know somebody at the ABA who's interested in talking to you. And we spoke, and he said he had, you know, read some of the things that I'd written and was interested. And we, you know, went about on a 2-year process putting it together, and it was published in October, just released on Amazon last week, and it's been great. It's a great thing for lawyers and young lawyers and law students to read, I think.
And what about peer reviews?
Peer reviews have been great. People have gotten a lot out of the book. I've had people change jobs because of the book. I've had people tell me it changed their life. I wasn't expecting that. But the feedback has been good, and the best feedback I think I've gotten is from non-lawyers telling me that they read it and they think it applies to any profession. And I wrote it for lawyers, but I've been getting a lot of that feedback from other people in other professions.
Well, let's talk about a part that I guess everybody can relate to. You speak of happiness and fun in practicing law, that lawyers often are not happy in their profession, but many are caught in that cycle of depending on their income, you know, whether it's school loans or whatever. So what do you suggest they do? Usually they're caught so much up in it, it's part of their identity. It's who they are.
Yeah, identity is a big issue with lawyers, and I think part of the problem is that, especially today, I think there's people who went to law school, and I'm not sure why they went to law school other than that there was nothing to do after college, or they thought it was a ticket to a lot of money, and then once they get into the profession, they realize this is not what they wanted to do. So I tell lawyers, one of the things you need to do is get a hobby. You cannot practice law 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You need to get away from it. You need to find other things to do. You need to go on a vacation, even if it's just for a night or two nights. And you need to find other things to talk about and other things to do. I think especially if you're not thrilled with what you're doing, you have to have some release from the daily grind of the practice of law, because clients, you know, they can take a year off of your life. And you need to find something that gets you away from the practice.
Or become a certified sommelier.
Right. And I'm glad.
Tell us about that.
Right. So as I tell people, you know, when some men turn 40, they jump out of airplanes. I became a certified sommelier. I did it because I've been into wine for a while and I wanted to get more educated. And I saw an ad for certification and I thought, you know, why shouldn't I do this? And I went to the class and I took some time off from work and took the test, not thinking I would pass the test. And there was 23 people in my class. 4 people were like me. They were professionals who were just doing this for absolutely no reason. Everyone else needed to pass for their job. And so I did. And people asked if I was going to continue becoming an advanced sommelier or a master sommelier. And I said, no, that's not in the cards for me. But it was a fun thing to do. And I'm very proud of it.
Did it change the way you practice law?
It didn't change the way I practiced law, except for the fact that it made me realize that there was other things that I could do other than the practice of law, take another test in another subject that had nothing to do with law, and enjoy something that was about geography and farming and things. And it just kind of broadened my mind about doing other things.
Someone who's indicted for a crime, they've hired you as an attorney. Of course, this is the biggest thing that they've ever faced in their life, probably. How do you handle the client that is just after you all the time? They want updates. They want you to give you additional information because they're so concerned about the case that they're almost kind of driving you crazy?
There's two things that I do. One of them I talked about in the book, which is called the mid-representation conversation, where you bring the client in. And you can do that at any time. When you feel like those kinds of things are happening, you bring the client in, you have a face-to-face, and you say, listen, I understand your situation. Here's what I've been doing. I can't continue to have this kind of relationship with you. It's just not going to work. And then maybe they'll tell you something that they didn't tell you before. And the other thing I will say is that you need to make this clear at the beginning, in the initial consultation, where most lawyers are just concerned about whether they're going to get a check. You need to decide whether this is the right client for you. I've had clients try to hire me over the phone who live here in Miami, and I say, I'd like you to come in. I want to sit down with you. I want to talk to you because I need to decide whether we're going to have a good relationship, whether we're a good fit. And I think the clients appreciate that. If those types of things start to happen, you need to put a stop to it, and you need to do it face-to-face because that's a bar complaint.
What if a client lies to you?
Well, clients lie all the time. Most people will say whatever they have to say to make themselves look good. You have to determine whether it's relevant to the case, and you have to be very open with the client and say, listen, I don't like surprises. You know, some lawyers, there's the old thing about, you know, do you want to know what happened? I want to know what happened. I want to know the truth. I want to know everything.
Don't lie to your lawyer or your doctor.
Right, right. You know, tell me anything you want to tell me. I'm not going to tell anybody. I probably heard it before, and it really doesn't matter to me. I just need to know the truth because I don't want the opposing counsel telling me this. I'd rather you tell me.
Do you defend clients that you know are guilty?
Well, all the time. Because the issue is not whether they're guilty. The issue is what are we going to do with them?
Okay.
I mean, I would, you know, hope that most people who get arrested for a crime actually committed the crime. Otherwise, we have a crisis in law enforcement. The issue is where do we go from here? Was there a legal reason to arrest them? Do they have a defense? And if not, how do we resolve the case so that they can move on with their life?
How did you become the lawyer who other lawyers go to when they are in hot water, and what's that like?
In 1999, I was asked to be on a grievance committee investigating lawyers, and I did that for 3 years, and I got off the committee, and I went back to my criminal practice. And a very prominent lawyer called me and said, I have a bar issue I'd like to discuss with you. And I said, okay, we discussed it. And after discussing it, he said, you know, you really sound like you understand this. I'd like you to represent me. And I said, I don't do that work. There's a few lawyers around town that do it. And he said, no, you're going to be my lawyer. And we handled the case, and my fee for that case actually was a bamboo plant. That was my first fee for representing a lawyer. And then I got another call a few weeks later from another lawyer who said he was referred by that lawyer. And now 13 years later, it's 75% of my practice.
Those bamboo plants are also known as money plants, I think.
We'll take a quick call. This is Alicia in Boca Raton. Hi, Alicia.
Hi. Good evening, David. I mean, so sorry, Brian. So sorry. Yeah. I have a question as a prospective law student, and I want to know why most lawyers deter prospective students from attending law school. Most lawyers that I ask tell me not to do it. Don't go to law school.
Brian?
Competition. I think most lawyers think there's too many lawyers, and that's why they're telling lawyers. I always tell people, listen, if you really want to be a lawyer, I want to have that conversation with you. I mean, I really wanted to be a lawyer. That's why I went to law school. If you really want to be a lawyer, I don't care what kind of lawyer you want to be, but if you really want to do it, then you should go to law school, because regardless of what's going on in the world with technology, with there being too many lawyers, there's always going to be room for good lawyers. And I will never deter a prospective law student from going to law school if, in fact, they are truly committed to the profession. If they just think it's a way to make money, I will probably encourage them to do something else. But if they're committed, I think you should go.
And we have a quick emailer. Undergraduate student discovered her interest in civil law. What should her next step be?
She should write and speak as much as possible, and keep her grades up.
Okay. Well, Brian Tannenbaum is a criminal defense attorney with Tannenbaum Weiss PL, now in his 21st year of practice, and a certified sommelier. He's written The Practice, Brutal Truths About Lawyers and Lawyering. Do you still have your blog, mylawlicense.com?
I do.
Okay. And his law firm is tannenbaumweiss.com. Well, thank you so much. It's been interesting.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction provided by online producer Paul Leary. We'll have this and past programs available for free downloads at our website, wlrn.org. And check out more links, photos, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is an At Your Service edition. We'll get the lowdown on the South Florida gardening picture from University of Florida Extension agent Dr. John Pippoli and Terry Goldsmith, the president of Florida Master Gardeners of Broward. If you long for just-picked homegrown tomatoes, September is the time to plant. Got that, Bonnie?
I got it. I'm going home and doing it. Oh, next month.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.